the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita once again singing Sunny as Only She Can. And Frank Sinatra saying, here's John, as only he can. Welcome to John Barber's World live at 5 p.m. Pacific time on BBS Radio from Las Vegas, where what stays here is your money. It is Labor Day, a holiday that has really lost its purpose and meaning since labor unions are now as rare as any book read by Donald Trump. They should now perhaps dedicate Labor Day just to women with children. Once again, today, the media is filled with what is wrong with Korea rather than what is wrong with us, America. A few weeks ago, they were telling us Korea tested a rocket. Then a couple of weeks after that, they tested an A-bomb. And now today, they're telling us they tested an H-bomb. To me, and I may be wrong, for the very first time. But all this was described perfectly by Shakespeare in Macbeth, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. But all this saber rattling between Korea's terrorists and America's tweeter, or penis rattling, if you will, is all beyond me, but not to Joe Satilli, who will be joining us a little later to explain it all. Right now, though, if you're at all interested in the murder of President John Kennedy and the investigation by Jim Garrison, there is no one on the planet more interesting and informed to talk about that than my guest. What a privilege and honor this is. He was one of Garrison's closest and most trusted investigators. He proved to Garrison and to the memory of Lee Harvey Oswald that the backyard pictures of Oswald were fake. He secured the Zapruder film for the Clay Shaw trial in Paris. I have pictures of him in the sewer at Dealey Plaza where Garrison thought a shot had been fired. You will hear this and much, much more. He was Mark Lane's best friend and closest collaborator, out soon with their new documentary. He was and is a major publicist and producer in Hollywood. He produced Mark Lane's great documentary, Rush to Judgment, in 1966, and the very first film on the assassination, Executive Action. He made major contributions to my first Garrison documentary, The Garrison Tapes, and also to Part 2, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, doing gangbusters on Amazon, thanks to you and thanks to reviews by people like him. A pleasure to introduce, a pleasure to talk to, Steve Jaffe. Steve, welcome to the show. Happy holiday. How are you and where are you?
Well, I'm here in Los Angeles, and it's a pleasure to be with you, John. I'm really honored to be with you after, 20 or so years gone by since we worked together on your wonderful documentary, The Garrison Tapes. And having now just seen the American media, the second assassination of President Kennedy, I think you've really done such a brilliant job of getting the truth out and getting the facts out. There's nothing to equal what you've done. It's just amazing, and I can't recommend enough to your audience that they pay $5 or whatever costs less to rent it and go on Amazon.com and get American Media, The Second Assassination of President Kennedy, and watch it. It's phenomenal.
Oh, Steve, thank you so much. But what is phenomenal is your life story and your experience with both Mr. Garrison and Mark Lane, because I always looked at you and Mark Lane as Siamese twins. It seemed like you were inseparable. Before we get to that, though, just give us a quick background on where you were born, what your childhood was like, what your aspirations may have been when you were a younger man, and what on earth brought you to Hollywood? How did you happen to end up there?
Well, I was born in California, and I, you know, my dad was a very famous cancer physician and research radiologist and surgeon, and he moved to Los Angeles and started the very first nuclear medicine department at Cedars-Sinai and in the world, and started using cobalt and other things to do research on curing cancer. That was in the 50s, and as a youngster, I lived a pretty, I think, privileged life. My father's a doctor, mother was a novelist, and I took an interest in photography, which is really what led me through the path that ultimately I met Mark Lane and met Garrison through Mark Lane, and got me involved in something that would ever forever change my life, which was the assassination of President Kennedy. I was a big admirer of Kennedy's. I'd send him a letter, a fan letter, if you will, and I received a letter back from him when I was going to college at UCLA. And so my roommates would tease me for thinking that he was as great as we all know he really was. So when it came to the assassination, I was shattered and heartbroken, as many, many millions of Americans were. And when I read Mark Lane's book, it just simply turned me around, and I
could
not imagine.
That was Rush to Judgment, right?
That was Rush to Judgment. I think I read it the month it came out, in 1966, in September. And I met him shortly thereafter because we had a mutual friend, and I said to him, listen, I don't know how can I go to college and study history when I know that the people who are writing history are writing lies. And I'd rather work for you. Is there any way I could volunteer? I don't need the money. And he said, well, there's a guy in New Orleans who's conducting an official investigation. He could help, use your help. I don't need any help. But he said, I'll introduce you to him. And that's what happened. He introduced me to Garrison. Garrison asked me if I had any skills. I told him I was a professional photographer. I was only 23. But he said, well, we have a pile of evidence that's photographic in nature, and we would love to have you come to work for us. And it was mainly because I had the backing of Mark Lane, and that he felt he could trust me because of that. Otherwise, I think he would have been much more cautious, but he was somewhat vulnerable.
Well, you recall in the documentary, Lou Ivan said that, you know, that Mr. Garrison was probably sometimes his own worst security risk, because he allowed almost anybody into his office, as he did.
Yeah, no question. And he allowed people, you know, Mr. Ivan and I once had a little bit of a falling out, which I'll tell you about, which was that we knew, those of us who were officially on the staff and who had licensed out of Baton Rouge, we were all aware of the fact that there were leaks coming out of the office, and that there were some people from the CIA in the office, and ultimately they plundered Garrison's case. But the fact was that everybody was suspicious of everybody else, and Garrison, because of his gullibility, because of his desire to trust people who wanted to help him. Yes, he did. He was his own worst enemy in that regard.
Well, that's sad. Now, when you joined him, did he give you any kind of tests to prove that you were really capable of what you were being able?
Yeah, he did a couple of times. He didn't want to give me anything too high level, although he was impressed that that was in February of 1967. His investigation was not well known yet. But anyway, he wanted to test me to see if I had investigatory skills of any kind. So he gave me an assignment to look up one of the people who had served in the Marine Corps with Lee Harvey Oswald, and that meant that I had to stay home. It was on a Friday, and he was in Los Angeles. He said, "You look into this and let me know." It was a guy named McDuff. "Let me know if you can track this guy down on Monday." So I spent the whole weekend. I didn't sleep. I called every McDuff in the phone book in Ireland, and I must have spent thousands of dollars, or what it would equal thousands of dollars of my father's money, because he was paying my phone bill, and I was going to college. I called every McDuff family in the phone book.
What did your father and mother think about the fact that you had gotten involved with Garrison and were spending their money on your phone bills?
Well, fortunately, they didn't get that particular bill for a couple of months. But and I did not find McDuff, wherever he may be. It certainly is not in Ireland. It wasn't at the time. But, they were worried, because not only were they worried about my safety, because, as you know, there were quite a few people being popped and killed who died of unnatural causes. Even at that point in time, that was well known. But they were worried that my father was worried that his practice, which was quite famous around the world, might suffer if his son's name got out in the press. So
oh,
I made a deal. You know, he was worried because, you know, if everybody knew that I was his son. So I said to him, "Dad, my name will never be mentioned in connection with the assassination investigation as long as I can control it." And I made a deal with Garrison. I said, "No matter what I do, I just want to contribute. I don't want any money, and I don't want any credit, because my father's worried about, you know, how the publicity, the controversy might, work in contradiction to his patients." So anyway, he said, "Okay, you may do things, but I'll never mention your name." And he would hold press conference after press conference to talk about the backyard photos or the investigation of the sewer on Dealey Plaza, or the trip I made to meet with de Gaulle and de Gaulle's the head of the Secret Service in Paris. He held many press conferences, but if you look through it, you'll see he doesn't mention the name of the office staffer who did these things. And
we're gonna retrace some of that, because, you know, he also never mentioned Hale Boggs as the fellow that gave him the doubts about the Warren Commission. He always said it was Senator Long. That was to protect Hale Boggs. That's the kind of honorable man he was. Well, let's rewind this a minute. Okay, you're 23 or 24 years of age. He sends you to Dallas to trace, I guess, the steps of Lee Harvey Oswald, and I have pictures of you in the sewer. Now, at that age, weren't you really frightened by what you were doing?
I tell you, when you're 23 years old and you feel you're doing something very important, the last thing you think about is your fear of what might happen to you. And I said to Mark, back in 2006, when Mark and I were on our way to London to do an interview with Mohammed Al-Fayed about the assassination of Princess Diana, I said to him, "You know, I don't feel like there's any amount of money that's worth getting killed over this." And he said, "Well, how'd you feel when we met and you volunteered for Garrison?" And I said, "You know what? I didn't care. It seemed somehow really the thing to do." But, you know, there were a lot of dangers ahead. And,
well, tell me about what you did when you – why did Mr. Garrison feel there was a shot from the sewer, even though I recall, I think he said Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent, said it sounded like there was an echo.
You're absolutely right. He said and if you look at Clint Hill's testimony – he's the Secret Service agent who went on the back of the limousine and pushed Jackie back into the car. But anyway, he said one of the shots sounded like it might have come from a bunker or an echo. And and I said to Garrison, when we were, he had asked me if I would do a photo analysis of Dealey Plaza, because I said I thought that we should know what it would look like from every point of view possible in the plaza, every building, every window, every witness who knew was there and where they were. We should see what they saw, just in terms of direction and perspective. So I went to Dallas, and I did that. Then I went back there, and I went to the clerk's office on assignment from Garrison, and I asked the county clerk for the sewer plans for the drainage system beneath Dealey Plaza and the grassy knoll. And I can't begin to tell you how strange the look was on the county clerk's face when I asked for those plans. That's probably the only thing that nobody had asked for. And I have them to this day, the drainage sewer plans, you know. And I got down in the sewer. I had some friends helping me, Mary Farrell's family and her sons. And I said, okay, we're going to open the sewer up in the dark at 4 in the morning. And then I'm going to get down in the sewer and take a picture from that area where there's an opening right on Elm Street. And I'm going to see you drive by in a convertible, and I will see if the angle is such that I could see somebody sitting in the back of a convertible, which we rented. We rented a Lincoln, and the kids drove by. Somebody was sitting back in the Kennedy position, and sure enough, you could see it. I took pictures from the sewer, and I also had pictures taken of me getting into the sewer pipe, the same sewer pipe that leads down below the grassy knoll, has an opening and an exit behind the fence on the grassy knoll, which is what you see. If you go to Dealey Plaza images, you can actually see there's a black and white picture of me getting in that drain. That's what you saw. We never felt it was conclusive, but Garrison was persuaded by my pictures to hold a press conference, which he did, and he published the photograph I took from that POV, from where the rifleman would have had to be.
Yes, and those plans, the sewer has been made smaller, and the sewer channels have been changed. Jim Mars tried unsuccessfully to find out who had changed that. There was, in The Men Who Killed Kennedy, about a 5 or 6 minute clip years and years later from a chemist who looked like he proved one of the shots came from the sewer. To this day, do you think one of the shots did come from the sewer? And did Mr. Garrison believe that?
No. He needed to do certain things to protect himself. And the media was either his worst enemy, well, it was always his worst enemy, but in some cases he had to feed the media what he was doing, unless it was something that we were doing undercover and it might jeopardize the investigation. Ultimately, we concluded that it was better, the vantage point, the point of view, all of the scientific work that was done to show that there were absolutely true trajectories from the grassy knoll to the limousine when Kennedy was hit first in the neck and then later in the head. And we did not think that the trajectory from the sewer was valid, but it was certainly a valid investigation. It proved that it was a perfect escape route.
It was obviously your investigation, just yours alone, was obviously more thorough than anything conducted by the Warren Commission. Now, Steve, you must have joined Mr. Garrison in early 67 before the New Orleans newspaper broke the story that he was investigating the crime. When that story broke in the newspaper, and we show in the documentary he was only spending $8,000 for his investigation, but when that story broke, what kind of change occurred in the office for your staff, and what kind of change occurred in the way the media began to look at Garrison?
Well, interestingly enough, there was a great deal of tension and dissension among some of the people on the staff, because those detectives, including Louis Ivan and some of the assistant district attorneys who worked on the staff, who had been with Garrison for the years he had been DA prior to the Truth or Consequences investigation, which was the Garrison Kennedy assassination investigation. Those people, you know, they didn't look kindly upon those of us who were being hired by Garrison, even though no money was going out. I paid for almost all of my expenses except the few that are in the National Archives. A matter of record, when I had to fly to Paris, I was given the money by the Garrison. But, you know, very minimal expenses involving my work, mainly because I could get the money on my own for my own professional work. But, you know, I was only too happy to do the work and pay for it. I, you know, that never occurred to me. But Garrison had a lot of enemies in the office, even those who were on the staff. They just felt that he was taking too much of a risk, and they were concerned about their own careers as lawyers beyond being assistant district attorneys.
Oh my goodness. Now let's get to the business of the trip to Paris, because Garrison had to take Time Life to the Supreme Court to rule on the Zapruder film, and the Supreme Court surprisingly ruled in his favor. But you claim that the film that they sent to him was almost unusable in the trial. Take it from there, and why you had to go to Paris to see de Gaulle.
Well, first of all, Garrison said to me one day when we were talking about things that the one piece of evidence that he really wanted was the Zapruder film, and that every time he would send a subpoena outside of the state of Louisiana, Hoover would block him, Hoover or, more importantly, the CIA. And in that case, by the way, let me just tell your listeners, the CIA of today is 180 degrees different from the CIA of those days. I mean, the CIA in those days viewed President Kennedy as someone who was blocking the door to their foreign policy. So they thought nothing of planning to kill him. It was something that I think even Johnson said, we're running a murder incorporated through the CIA. And the fact is they planned it and they eliminated someone who was in their way. But, you know, the question, you know, about Garrison and the Zapruder film was when he first got the film in answer to his subpoena, we opened it up and we looked at it, and it looked like the film hadn't even been exposed. You know, it didn't look like a copy of the Zapruder film. You could see almost nothing photographed in that piece of film. It was only, you know, 26 seconds long, but it was the same general length, but you could barely make out any images. And so he said, go to Washington, look at the Zapruder film that they show for people there at the National Archives. I did. I came back and I said, it looks fine. You can make out everything. And the thing that's the most powerful thing you'll ever see is that when Kennedy is hit in the final fatal shot at Zapruder 313, he moves violently backwards. There's no question about it. It came from the right front, which is consistent with all the other evidence. So we had, because of something way too long to get into now, we had contact with the Russian intelligence through French intelligence. And the Russian and the mostly the French intelligence, because de Gaulle, as you may know, was very close to the Kennedys. He loved JFK and he loved Jackie, and he would do anything to help afterwards, and we contacted him, and they got in touch with us and provided us with a lot of information, which I'll go into later. But they asked me to come to Paris because we needed information and we needed evidence we could take into court. So in the lead run up to the trial, when he was filing for the Supreme Court to make a decision about Time Life, I was able to go to Paris and meet with the head of the Secret Service, who was literally two doors away from de Gaulle, and he said, we'll give you anything we can. We can show you the rifle that killed Kennedy, the same model. It was a German Mauser 7.65 millimeter. He said, this is a copy, this is a replica of that. But he said, what can we do for you? And I said, well, we really need a copy of the Zapruder film that's a really good copy. And I knew that they had a, that Perry Match had a sister, was a sister publication to Life magazine, and that they had been sent a copy of, like, a first or second generation copy. And so De Gaulle, who actually gave me a note, scribbled a note on the card and handed it to me, he said he'd do anything they could. And so by the time I got back to Los Angeles, I got a call literally within hours of me arriving back in Los Angeles from Paris and then New Orleans. And it was an agent they had sent to the Beverly Hills Hotel, and he said, come right over. I went over there, and he actually had a copy of the Zapruder film that was in some French stockings. And he said, these are for your girlfriend. And I said, you flew all the way from Paris to give me stockings for my girlfriend? He said, open them up. I said, what? Are you cat? Anyway, I opened them up, and hidden in the stockings was a little gray, I still have it to this day, a little gray reel upon which was a perfect generation copy, a first or second generation copy of the Zapruder film, which I got on the plane and immediately delivered to Garrison.
What was the reaction in the courtroom when they saw this pristine film for the first time?
It's the same reaction that people get who see this film for the first time. There's no question but that Kennedy, who was not mortally wounded, it's very, very likely he would have lived with the first shot that hit him in the neck and the shot that hit him in the back. It was only that shot in the head, which people see in the Zapruder film, that was the fatal shot and drove him so fast and back into the seat that he bounces off the seat, and his head is literally blown apart. And, you know, there's no question. He was fatally wounded, but from a shot on the grassy knoll. And there's no question about it. It's the most powerful piece of evidence I've ever seen in any criminal case.
Why do you think the FBI did not sequester that film and hide it? Why is it still public? I mean, they took the Knicks film, they've taken other footage. Why do you think it's still out there?
Well, there is, you know, the Kennedy assassination, the plot was, the hardest part of the plot was not the assassination. It's easy to kill even a head of state. And they were professionals, the CIA, in those days, Dulles and Angleton and Helms and all those guys. They would hire the best hitmen in the mafia or anti-Castro Cubans to do the dirty work, and so they did. But what happened was they did sequester and hide, like the first Mormon picture, which shows that the place where Oswald was supposed to be on the sixth floor is empty. There's nobody in the window there. And other films actually show that, but not to the degree that Mary Mormon's photo would have shown it. They just took that and took it away. We've never seen it, ever since then. Why did they not get to the Zapruder film? I think it was just a matter of control. The press, on the part of Dan Rather, who to this day describes the Zapruder film as if he's looking at a cartoon that somebody else made, it's like he's on acid or something. But he and the guy from Life magazine, Stoll, who were trying to buy the Zapruder film, they were at the lab. And Zapruder was clever enough to realize how important what he had was. Not necessarily for the money, because I don't think he was really in it for the money, although what, $50,000 was a lot of money to make. And that's what he got in the beginning. Later he got millions. But I think Zapruder got enough of the media with him at the place where the film was developed and then screened, so that they couldn't kill it. But what Hoover did was he ordered Life magazine, in ways which we know some of the ways, not all of them. He ordered Life magazine not to ever sell it or give it to anybody that would run it in motion. They were only allowed to publish it in still frames. And if you look at the four issues of the Zapruder film, you never see it. It's published there, but it's not in motion. when Garrison showed the film in the trial, people nearly lost their lunches, and some did, actually, because it's so gruesome, but it's also so powerful. There's no way in the world that anybody behind him could have fired that fatal shot. And that's what happened.
In the courtroom, Garrison, or those attorneys who argued on behalf of his case, obviously presented a lot of very convincing evidence that Clay Shaw was indeed involved with the CIA. And I'm going to put that on pause for just a second, because you said that CIA of the assassination year 1963 is not like the CIA of today. It seems to me, because there is a map in the American media in the second assassination of John F. Kennedy, a map of the USA, and then you hear four gunshots and it's changed to CIA. And that we did because Jim Garrison in the film says they still assassinate in America today. So why did you say they're slightly different?
Well, if you see what happened to this country, which was almost as bad as an assassination, which is the last election, the result of that was that the person who now occupies the Oval Office, although I have a trouble calling him the president, anyway, he attacked the intelligence community vociferously, and he makes about every mistake you can possibly make in terms of public relations, which is something I know a little bit about. And I don't know what his reasoning was, but he has criticized and lambasted the FBI and the CIA and the intelligence community, all of whom have said without any question that the Russians have literally, not only did they hack the election, they created his presidency. And he's trying to defend against that criticism. But now, having fired Mueller, what we see is that little dribs and drabs, not so little, very important if you watch the right channel and stop watching Fox and watch MSNBC. But the truth of the matter is, and you could do a wonderful documentary about this, I pray that you do, the CIA today is trying to save the government from absolute destruction by the person who occupies the Oval Office. And it's not like in the days of James Jesus Angleton and Richard Helms and Alan Dulles and Bissell and Cabell and all of those people who are responsible for the Kennedy assassination. It's not like that now. Those people...
Well, what an interesting observation. So now I'm going to go back to the trial. Garrison... Yeah. And those arguing that Clay Shaw, and proving probably that Clay Shaw is connected with the CIA. And there's this it looks like it's going to be a prosecution witness shows up that Mark talks about in the film. And that literally destroyed the case, but there was a conviction for perjury. Why did the government stop that? Why did they stop Garrison from pursuing Clay Shaw for a conviction of perjury?
Well, the fact was that Garrison knew that it's kind of interesting. I think of Robert Mueller in a similar position right now. Garrison obviously couldn't be fired, but he was the district attorney, and he knew that he had somebody in his jurisdiction other than Oswald who had been conspiring with Oswald and Ferry and other people who was connected to the CIA. About that, there is no longer any doubt. That has been confirmed under testimony from Richard Helms, who was the director of the CIA. But the fact is that the thrust of the trial, according to Garrison, what he told me, was I'm going to get all of the evidence about who killed the president, and that being the CIA. I'm going to get all of that evidence into a courtroom where it can be tested, and I'll do the best I can, and if they kill me, I don't care. And if they decide that Shaw is innocent because the CIA gets its meat hooks into the jury or whatever they do, I'm going to move this ahead, and I'm going to do this until the day I die. And many times there were real reasons to believe that he might be killed, but the point was he brought the case, and the FBI and the CIA successfully destroyed it, and they gave all of the evidence that he had to Clayshaw's defense attorneys on the eve of trial. One of our staffers gave the trial memo and all the evidence to the Shaw's attorneys, but also they planted witnesses, this guy Speisel. They planted
yes.
witnesses in to make a complete joke out of the trial so that the jury could not convict. And but Garrison wasn't he wasn't dismayed. He was happy. He was capable of getting all that evidence into a real courtroom with real jurors and real rules of evidence, and he did it, and it's there forever.
Steve, I want to keep you on forever. I have so many things I wish to ask you. Do you mind if we're now joined by Joe Satilli, who is my regular cohort? He writes a magnificent daily newsletter called News Vandal. And I think his observations are similar to yours about the man who occupies the White House now. Do you mind if he is there?
No, I'd be delighted. I'd be delighted.
Okay. Joe, are you there? Doug, could you bring Joe on if he's there?
He's with us
okay.
now. He's with us now.
Okay, Joe, how are you?
Doing great. How are you, John?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Thank you. And thank you, Steve, for letting me have Joe join you, because I'm sure he has a million questions to ask, and he has some observations to make also about Trump. But let me ask you just a couple of questions. Time went by, and your parents and your father must have realized that you had been connected with helping Jim Garrison. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the first thing I showed my dad was a letter, because I said to Garrison, you know, I don't know how you guys do it, but if I'm going to interview people, like I interviewed Lauren Hall, was one of the three people who accompanied Oswald, the anti-Castro Cubans, to meet with Silvio Odio. I said, if I'm going to interview people like this, I'm going to have to show them some sort of credentials. And he said, Steve, I'll give you a letter. He said, I'll give you a letter. We have to get the credentials have to be authorized out of Baton Rouge. We'll get those to you as soon as possible. And I was, at the time, living at home. And so, you know, the credentials came, and my dad opened the mail because it said, you know, district attorney, state of, you know, New Orleans, Louisiana, actually it's Orleans Parish. And my dad, you know, all I remember is him pouring the biggest scotch I've ever seen and saying, Steve, I got to talk to you. So, I mean, it went to his address, and, you know, it was funny. But I was then, it was not a happy thing for my family, although my dad lived to 96, and he lived to see Obama elected, and he also said to me, not long after the Garrison trial, he said, you were right, and I was wrong. And that was a big thing for my dad.
How wonderful to hear. Okay, I'm going to ask two questions, and then I'm going to ask Joe to ask you a couple of questions. You started to make executive action, which was truly an obvious and interesting film about the Kennedy assassination. Was that difficult to get financed and done? And did some of the actors, were some of them agreeable about doing it for not too much money?
Yeah, nobody took any money at the outset, although they had a very hefty piece of the back end, something that I didn't even know about at the time, really, except for my work in the film industry. But no, Burt Lancaster and Robert Ryan and Will Geer all did it for no money in front and just a piece of the back end, you know, out of the gross, actually. The first guy to get involved was Donald Sutherland, who was not just a
really?
Friend of mine, but a client. And Donald Sutherland said to Mark Lane, who was my friend, and he said, you know, I'd like to do a film like that, and I'd like to play you. So it got started that way, and I put Donald Sutherland together with Ed Lewis, and Ed Lewis was a man with great politics. And he, if you look at Ed Lewis on the IMDb and you see the incredible films that he made that had to do with different events and the work that he did, you'll see. And he was a powerhouse producer, and he had done a lot of very successful films. Anyway, to make a long story short, if it weren't for Ed Lewis and his power, and a national general eventually picked up the tab, and it was ultimately sold, unfortunately, to Warner Brothers. But Executive Action was did a land office business. It made a huge amount of money because it cost almost nothing to make.
How interesting. Okay, then the other thing I want to mention before I turn it over to Joe and you is you mentioned that you and Mark went to England to do an interview and to quote you about the assassination of Diana. Now, in the last week, there have been about a dozen documentaries about Diana, and I think I saw an obscure YouTube about 3 years ago about a court ruling in England that ruled her death a suspicious death, not mentioned once in any one of these documentaries. Why do you call it an assassination?
Well, Mark Lane and I examined the evidence, and I tried for a solid year to get a friend of mine who was a colleague in the public relations field for movies, who represented a lot of clients, and he was out of London, and he represented Muhammad al-Fayyad. So after Mark and I had been through the assassination of President Kennedy and worked on the investigation of the assassination of Martin Luther King, I just felt it was natural for us to take on another one. And that was, I wanted to get a meeting, having read through a lot of very startling evidence, I wanted to get a meeting with Muhammad al-Fayyad. And it took me a year. I finally got the meeting. Mark and I went over there. We sent ahead a lot of information to brief him on, but we had no idea what we were going to meet or what it's going to be like when we got there. And basically what you see these days are what they call mockumentaries, because I call them mockumentaries because they don't tell the truth at all. And it's not surprising to know that these documentaries have just, you know, done it again, as I say, that, you know, they say that Diana died in the car crash, and, you know, the drunk driver was at fault. And all of that's bullshit. But...
No,
I didn't mean, to say Trump. But anyway... The documentary that was made and the actual official British inquest that was held after the initial stories, the judgment by a court of people who are appointed by the British government said that the death of Diana in that car crash was unlawful. And it was,
that's,
as a result.
I thought it was the word suspicious. It's unlawful. Joe, please join us here and give us, because you have some really interesting stuff in your news vandal today.
Oh, it's about North Korea Palooza.
Yeah, about North Korea and about Trump. And I have the feeling, I don't want to speak on your behalf, but I have the feeling that your thoughts about the current occupant of the White House might be exactly the same as those of Steve and many others.
Well, yeah, I try to be circumspect about it because I think we're just into pure infotainment now. I think Donald Trump was elected in no small part because he got about $5+ billion worth of free media, because he brilliantly had these incredibly entertaining rallies almost every day, and cable news cut to them almost every day and carried them in full. And so he had an ongoing relationship with them, and he actually rescued the cable news industry. They were in deep crisis. You know, CNN was pulling about 400,000 viewers on an average day. MSNBC was under 400,000. Fox was hovering around 1 million. And they've all seen massive increases in viewership and in revenue. So what I see here is this odd interplay where America has become what America is, which is basically a giant reality show. And so in terms of policy, I think that Donald Trump's only real policy is airtime. I think that's his policy objective. So it's really hard to unpack him as a politician. And I know we're all revulsed by him. I think we should kind of be used to him, or try and get used to what's going to be unfolding here over the next couple of years, because I think it's going to be very difficult to eject him. I think he's worked with Steve Bannon, and Steve Bannon left the administration purposefully so that he and now Chris Kobach and Sebastian Gorka, Seb Gorka, what a name, the Hungarian hustler, I like to call him, they're basically out of the administration now so that they can basically operate freely and gin up his base and keep his base intact, because I think they realize that if they've got 36% of the population, they've got a gun to the head of the Republican Party.
One of the observations that Steve made, I found really, really interesting, is the fact that he talked about the fact that Trump was attacking all the intelligence agencies, yeah, from the FBI to the CIA. October 26th, all of the remaining documents are supposed to be released about the assassination of John Kennedy. And when I asked Steve why it was the CIA was different today than when they killed Kennedy, he said, because now they're more interested in saving the Republic from the current occupant of the White House.
Yeah. No, I think that there are a couple interesting things. I wrote a very extensive piece back in August where I called him the Hindenburg of all conspiracy theories. And so basically, you know, all of his wild conspiracy theories that he has peddled for the last 2 years, and actually going back 5 years, birtherism and all these things that he has ginned up, when he goes down in flames, I think a lot of critical thought is going to go down in flames with him. I don't know if this is a controlled demolition of critical thought, but it's functionally operating that way, because there are so many conspiracy theories now attached to him. What the CIA wanted to do to the term conspiracy theory at the end of the 60s has just been multiplied by 10,000. I mean, it's the CIA's, you know, dream come true with Donald Trump. On the other hand, he is also, I think, an example of some of the success that people like Steve Jaffe had in actually creating doubt in the official story. And I think that on some level, we are a nation that does not trust the official story anymore for good reason. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Mr. Jaffe, was do you still have hope of the big breakthrough that will finally open the dam? Or do you think we're actually past that point of breakthrough on the JFK assassination? And is there something that you think is sitting out there? You know, John mentioned these documents that everybody's eagerly waiting for. Is there one last thing that you're hoping for that might actually open the floodgates on the Kennedy assassination?
Well, the answer is no. I think that the CIA, who classified those documents top secret back in 1961, 62, 63, and certainly 64 and on, that CIA that killed Kennedy did not want those documents to ever see the light of day. And even though we can, because it's complicated, in looking at a document, you can look at a document, and if you don't have the right knowledge, as exhibited in John Barber's filmmaking, if you don't know what he knows or know what I know from having studied this case for over 50 years, then you may not see something that looks like it's of any value. On the other hand, there may be accidentally documents that are released, and they're already beginning to come out, actually. They're not waiting till October 26th. That's just the deadline. But there's so many tons of documents that are there that it'll take a long time for people who are in this field who are doing research to decipher them. But
Steve, what about the documentary that you're about to release now that you and Mark were just working on?
The documentary that we're working on is to take another look from the standpoint of Robert Tannenbaum, who is the head of the House Select Committee investigation of the homicide division, formerly of the head of the homicide division of Manhattan, at the DA's office. He was the head of the House Select Committee investigating the Kennedy assassination. And he and Sprague quit because it was very clear to them that the government wasn't going to let them follow the facts wherever they led. But at the same time, a lot of work was done, and there can be a contribution in terms of the, what's coming. But what I want to say is that in your documentary, both of your documentaries, the Garrison Tapes and this new one, and what I tell people all the time is that the evidence is there. It's already out. And
right.
there may be other evidence that comes out that surfaces, like this incredible memo from the director, John McCone, to the head of the Secret Service about Oswald's having been trained by the CIA. It makes no bones about it. It just says maybe we shouldn't show this to the Warren Commission. It might be a bad idea, which is a little tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, I appreciated the humor. But the main thing is that that document was released, and nobody in the media who, you know, they're all so trained to say Lee Harvey Oswald, that nobody noticed it. Nobody put it into context. And that's the kind of reaction you can expect. Nothing from the media. Nothing, no matter what happens. Marita Lorenz published a book, her third book, 2 days ago, or it's about to be published, about her relationship with Castro and how she traveled to Dallas with the people who were killing Kennedy, who were about to kill Kennedy, and left there the day before it happened. And Marita Lorenz, who's a very important person in this case, you know, she's told her story. She's testified to it.
Yes.
And all they have to do is say, well, I'm sorry, but her testimony was determined to be unreliable. Well, that's like saying that if somebody who really had valuable testimony, like Roger Craig, didn't testify before the Warren Commission, that was unreliable or it wasn't worthy. The truth is,
when I was interviewing Jim Garrison back in 1980, one of the things that I missed the most, Mr. Garrison had to go up and get up and answer a phone call. And Mark Lane sat in his chair, and the cameras were still rolling. And I asked Mark who was the guy who gave the orders to change the parade route, and he mentioned the guy's name. I can't remember it offhand. And then we started to talk about Jonestown. And he asked me, did you get my book on Jonestown? And I said, no, I know little about it. He says, I'll get you one and autograph it to you. And then he started to tell me about Jonestown when Mr. Garrison reappeared. And I never got the book. I got so tied up in everything else.
Strongest poison.
Yeah, so my last question would be, what was it about Mark Lane in Jonestown that fascinated Mark and that has some people, even to this day, somewhat critical of Mark's involvement with Jonestown?
Boy, that's the question you want to close with. I'm sorry. But, you know, first of all, you know, I'd like to be back on your show when you have a 24-hour show. And we can do what David Susskind used to do and call it open end.
Believe me, you will be back on the show many, many times. So that way, you know, we won't go into that.
I couldn't begin to do justice to the answer to that. It's a very valid question. I do know the answer to the question. I have been asked it many, many times because I was one of Mark's closest friends for the better part of 55 years or 50 years until he died a couple of years ago. I mean, actually, it seems like it was last year, I think it was. Anyway, I can answer that question, and boy, it really deserves an answer. So I will help you with that whenever I get a chance to, you know, come back with you.
Well, you will be back. When are you going to be releasing this documentary that you guys just finished?
We just finished a documentary. It's narrated by Martin Sheen, and it's called it's either called A Rush to Judgment or maybe Conspiracy in America. It depends on a lot of things that don't matter. Conspiracy in America has the CIA or the initials of the words, but we're going to try and get that out in before the end of the year. And I have a book that's based on nothing more than Commission Exhibits 133A and B, the photograph that was on the cover of Life magazine in February of 1964 of Oswald in the backyard. And so it says, with the rifle that he used to kill President Kennedy and the pistol that he used to kill, the gun that he used to kill Tippit. All this book does is shatter that to bits, as I did before the Rockefeller Commission when I testified in Washington. So that's in October and November, and the documentary will be out soon.
Well, and we will have you back then to talk both about the book and the documentary. Did Garrison, in his investigation, ever find out what happened to the Mauser?
No. All we know is that the three people who found it, all three of them, and I have this right here, and that's going to be in my book, they swore in affidavits that it was a 7.65 Mauser. And two out of, well, three, all three were police officers. One owned a sporting goods store, as you know. And they all said it was a Mauser, and then they ran into trouble because the false Oswald had ordered a Mannlicher Carcano. So they had to switch it. What happened to it? I will tell you that the Dallas police and some of the people in the sheriff's office, especially the Sheriff Decker and the office of Henry Wade, they helped to lose or destroy a lot of evidence. And I believe that that was taken away with the people who shot the president.
Well, thank goodness for people like you, Steve, that all of this information is recorded for history, will always be there, and maybe someday brought up in a prosecution case against people who are still alive. Joe, thank you very, very much for joining us.
No, just I'm grateful to sit in and listen. It was an amazing hour.
Oh, my gosh, it was. Steve, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Give my love to Susan. She's an incredible lady and a terrific, terrific actress. And you will be back probably within 6 or 7 weeks to do this again. And after that, you're going to come back again and do it often, because you are indeed a treasure to talk to and a pleasure to be with.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Joe. I was very interested in what you're doing in your publication. And I will immediately become a subscriber.
Oh, great.
Thank you so much. Again, thank you all for going to Amazon for $1.99 and getting this incredible documentary in which you can see Steve. And I want to thank Joe again. He was the associate producer on that documentary. And as Ed Murrow used to say, good night and good luck.
A sunny, 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 I love you.